Well, good morning and welcome to the Ninth Circuit. I'm glad to be here with my colleague Judge McKeown, and Judge Boggs has kindly agreed to join us as a visiting judge, and we're certainly grateful for his work to help us manage our caseload. We have three arguments set to be heard this morning, so just watch your time. Let us know if you want to reserve rebuttal time, and just try and sum up as your time is concluding. If it's red and counting upwards, it doesn't mean you got extra time. That means you're out of time. Obviously, if we take you over, that'll be fine. But with that, we'll go ahead and get started with the first argument set, which is United States versus Myers, case number 23-1034. And who do we have? We have Mr. Pope first? Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. From Boise, Idaho.
Yes.
All right. Well, good. A good state. So hopefully that will bode well for you. All right. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. Miles Pope for Ronald Myers, and I'd reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Interpreting Section 364 in to apply only to windfalls and not to gradual accumulations of resources offers the best reading of that provision and avoids numerous interpretive and practical problems that the government's interpretation creates. Limiting 364N to windfalls first provides a principled explanation for why, as is common ground in this case, 3664N excludes prison wages. Second, it minimizes surplusage in the...
So can I ask about that? Because the windfall, I understand the practical arguments, but I'm trying to look at the language, and I just want to be clear about where the windfall except, because it has been adopted, including from the Great Circuit of the Sixth Circuit, I guess, in a way. And I'm trying to figure out linguistically where that comes from. Does that come from the substantial, or does that come from the three examples?
It comes from it comes from the three examples. So, I mean, you have to read them in tandem, but essentially, as I think the courts have analyzed it, and I think they've got it right, the POF panel, as well as the Sixth Circuit and the other courts that have weighed in, basically you're trying to give effect to every word in the statute. So you have substantial resources from any sources naturally read as singular, and then...
we've got a host of problems, because that's not necessarily true. Source singular is commonly, any source is almost inevitably a plural as well. Any source is any source, whether it's singular or plural. It doesn't say a source, it says any source.
Yeah. The singular includes the plural. That's a common canon of construction, isn't it?
Well, I think two points in response to that. The first is, Congress had available any sources, including, and they could have said that. But secondly, if the court views any source as essentially, you know, if not ambiguous, at the very least, you know, unhelpful to resolving this problem, I think you go on to look at the enumerated list of examples and you ask, okay, what is the purpose of those examples?
Well, the difficulty with that analysis is you have to start with any. And that has a very clear meaning, doesn't seem ambiguous, but to the extent that inheritance, settlement, or other judgment is clarifying, it's not limiting.
Agree. It's not limiting, but it also, I think we...
Go ahead.
I think the court needs to look at those words, those three enumerated examples, and ask, okay, well, what is their function? What is their purpose in the statute? And it seems to me that as previous panel of this circuit and courts have held, you know, you look at something that they all have in common, and what they all have in common is that they are essentially, they are a form of windfall. They're sort of out of the ordinary.
I want to push back on that a little bit, because I'm not sure that I buy into that. An inheritance, I mean, I'll bet you could look at a lot of inheritances that aren't windfalls. I mean, there's a lot of inheritances where you just get a nominal amount of money, you know? And so I'm not sure why inheritance, you're right, other courts have said that, but it's not intuitive to me why inheritance means windfall.
To address the question from a slightly different angle, there is this beginning data point, which is that we have courts that have held that prison wages are not subject to seizure under subsection N.
Well, I mean, that's a whole separate question, and I'm going to ask the government about that because that's not intuitive to me either. But that appears to be what the government's clear position has been, and you're right, that's where they've interpreted it. But that seems to be a different issue. I mean, prison wages are, I mean, what are we talking about? It's like a dollar an hour or?
Not substantial in any event.
Well, but if there are accumulations of, so let's say you're in Unicorn, you're making a $1.15 an hour over, and you're working full time 5 days a week, you know, that's in 6 months that accumulates to the equivalent of what the government sought to seize in this case. And so I think you do, there is a problem there, like to, in terms of, you know, the government, there is one way this court could go, and it could say if it accepts the government's concession and it doesn't want to create a circuit split, it could say, look, prison wages are its own unique beast. There are a bunch of policy reasons for us to basically carve them out of the statute. But that's not how statutory interpretation is supposed to work. You need to provide a coherent and, you know, interpretation or construction of the statute that actually has textual integrity. And my interpretation, the interpretation I've advanced, where you limit subsection N to windfalls, to, you know, large, single, out-of-the-ordinary grants accomplishes that objective.
Let me ask you, in linguistics, about the inheritance settlement, the phrase is inheritance settlement or other judgment. And to me, an inheritance requires a judgment, settling a will or an intestacy. Settlement of a case is a judgment. That's why those things were put in, not to make a windfall definition, but just to put them in to make sure that we are including things that are judgments. Those are the three things, other judgment.
I mean, that's one thing that all three of those examples have in common. I think that the POF court, the other courts that have interpreted this more broadly to apply to windfalls writ large, have been trying to give effect to the expansive phrase at the beginning. So this, you know, to any.
The substantial.
To substantial resources from any source, specifically.
To me, substantial is where this case, the focus has been on these last three examples, but to me the focus really should be on substantial. Because if windfall is going to come anywhere, I think it's got to be shoehorned into substantial. I'm not sure it fits, but it seems to fit more clearly there than it does in these three examples. You'll take the argument however you can get it.
No, I love that. But the other thing I would say is that I appreciate the desire to really home in on, okay, what is the exact, like, snippet of text in this statute that we want to look at. I do think it needs to be read in context as a whole, which, you know, brings me to, it's sort of resisting the court's line of questioning a little bit, and I don't mean to do that.
Well,
but
no, I mean, I get your point, but to me, context would be totally different if substantial wasn't there. I mean, obviously, if it didn't say substantial, then the inference would be anything. You know, any amount of money could come in. Substantial has to mean something.
I agree.
I just don't know that it means windfall.
So I agree it needs to mean something, and I think that if you read that entire phrase, substantial, the Sixth Circuit has noted, substantial means large, significant. I agree with that. Resources from any source, which, again, push back on this, but singular, including, and then there's this list of things, all of which have in common, it's basically a single, out-of-the-ordinary grant. I think that reading gives effect to every word in the statute.
Well, I would argue the opposite. I think it would mean that don't exclude these three things, just because it's an out-of-the-ordinary, I won't call it windfall, arrival of resources or money. So that's the other way to read this, is that if you say resources from any source, you say, well, you know, it's not really fair if I got this inheritance. You know, that's my family, or I settled my lawsuit. And basically the statute is saying, no, even though these things might seem near and dear to you because they're special, they're included. So it's like flipping it instead of trying to find its cousins or its brothers or sisters, you know, because it's got these three words. So I would go at it backwards from where you're going at it.
Well, it's unclear to me why. I mean, I'm not entirely sure that Congress would have thought that if they just deleted that list of examples and just said substantial resources from any source. I mean, I don't know if there's any, I mean, certainly the government hasn't pointed to any sort of background assumptions or beliefs that would say, well, you'd exclude judgments and settlements from that language, and the language would be clear. So it doesn't seem to me that Congress
is doing
what
they had, because I thought there was some other statutes that had actually excluded inheritances in certain circumstances from judgment collection.
Absolutely, and that illustrates that when inheritances are excluded, the legislatures act to affirmatively and explicitly exclude them. I think that actually supports.
Yeah. Can I just ask quickly on the circuit split? Because you suggested that we would be creating a circuit split, and I'm not sure I agree with that. I want to hear your response, because as I tally this up, we got the Fifth Circuit. I mean, and the cases aren't exactly cohesive. They're all coming at this from different ways, but we got the Fifth and the Sixth Circuit and maybe the First Circuit that sort of adopt at least some portion of your analysis, but we also have the Eighth and the Seventh and the Tenth that go the other way. Now, granted, some of those are unpublished. So, I mean, isn't there already at least some tension in the circuits, if not a clear split on this
issue?
Well,
with respect to the Eighth is the published case that I think I need to address most firmly, because that's actually published. And I resist the government's reading of that. The government sort of suggests, well, there's some ambiguity, but the Eighth Circuit's, you know, the language in the Eighth Circuit case in U.S. v. Kidd essentially, you know, asserts that it is substantial resources from, you know, an outside source. And then it is true that later on in Kidd, you know, they note that additionally the $5,000 at issue could include the receipt of substantial resources from outside sources that would be subject to Section 366(4)(n). But if you read on from there, the next sentence, and that's a sentence that the government keys in on in its answering brief, the next sentence is, or perhaps more likely, the $5,500 may be an accumulation of small amounts received from various sources that together amount to a material change. So I think what the Eighth Circuit is doing, again, to solve the prison wage problem, is saying, look, you cannot, you know, a single outside source may amount to substantial resources. And that single outside source, even in the context of $5,500, if you get $4,500, maybe that's substantial resources, but that's a single outside source. I don't read that as walking back from the analysis that it leads with earlier on when it's trying to explain why prison wages, are not subject to seizure under subsection N. So from the published cases perspective, I do think this court will be opening up a split, based on the analysis that those cases, undertake. I'm blinking red.
Yeah, you are. So but again, we took you over, so you're fine. We'll give you some time for rebuttal.
I appreciate that.
We'll hear from the government.
Thank you.
Good morning. Brian Donovan on behalf of the United States. If it may please the court, this is as the court has already honed in on, I think a very simple statute with some very relatively clear language that I think...
Well, you say it's clear, and yet we've got about six opinions that all come out different ways.
Yeah, I agree, but I think that, like you said earlier, Your Honor, the opinions are coming at these from different directions, and I think this is the first case that's coming at it from this direction. And I would disagree with my opposing counsel about his overstatement, I think, of creating a circuit split here. If you look at Carson from the Sixth Circuit, it didn't really wrestle with this question. In fact, it talked about how the problem in Carson was the court didn't do the analysis that this court did, where it looked at the entire ledger. It didn't look at the ledger. It didn't know where the money was coming from in the inmate's account and send it back.
Carson was focused primarily, maybe solely, on whether prison wages were substantial.
Correct. And the district court hadn't done an analysis of what the money was, and it sent it back, and it actually talked about if there was a few dollars put in a commissary account, that would be one thing, but if there are thousands of dollars placed in by family and friends, that would be another thing, and it sent the decision, sent it back for remand to do that analysis. That is what we have here.
Did anything come of that remand that you know about?
I don't know.
Because I did spend a good bit of time with this ledger. And the practical question I have is kind of, how did you glom onto this guy this particular year? He's been in prison for 10 years. He's been getting the same kinds of money all along. If you win your case, I presume that the family will quit sending him money. They'll put it in a bank account in wherever he's from, or he'll spend it down every time so it never becomes substantial. So is there a new drive to do this to all the prisoners in Eastern Washington or in the whole U.S. or how, as a practical matter, how did you get this started?
As a practical matter, Your Honor, it's something that we've done for a while, the Department of Justice, but after, to be frank, after the COVID stimulus checks were sent to prisoners across the country, there was more information was provided to our offices about prisoners who had substantial resources. Partly that was we would look and see what the balances were. And again, it goes to the substantial resources that Judge Nelson was talking about. Maybe $1,200 or $1,600 might not seem substantial to some people, but when somebody's paying $25 a quarter or $100 a year, $1,200 is a substantial recovery to the
right.
victim.
But do you agree with me that the only reason he has a balance, the ledger doesn't tell what the balance was at the start of the year, but he obviously spent a good bit of money in prison. That is $3,000 or $4,000 kind of, I presume, went to commissary or sneakers or something. But he could have easily, you know, kept that balance even lower and you would never have noticed it.
Yeah, and that, I agree. That's also part of the collection difficulties that the government faces with not just this case, but thousands of cases, right? Is defendants are spending money. And if we catch the bank account at the right time, we get the commissary at the right time or the retirement account at the right time, terrific, then we're taking action. We look at a lot of other defendants who may have had big balances, but they spent them down before we could.
And is it true that the sort of pre-release balance that is mentioned occasionally, that's not really a separate thing?
I am not as familiar with the way BOP does its accounting. Opposing counsel says that this is a specific account, but all the money goes into one commingled account. And whether he has...
They were segregated because he had to have some that was set for savings for when he was released.
Yeah, and he can tell the BOP to counselors to parcel off some his subjective.
So does that
belief.
Mean you're not trying to go after pre-release balances?
I believe all this money is within both with his in his
so
accounts.
Then you are.
So it could be both, but
so at least from a penological point of view, you're saying there's no point in saving for your release because we're going to grab it.
I'm not sure that's the case, Your Honor, because first of all, this defendant's not being released until 2040, so we have a significant amount of time for him to continue to
save. Well, he owes $2.6 million on another judgment. Maybe you'll be able to collect by then.
I believe I did the math. I think his current rate of payment in this case, just our case, of $35,000 in restitution would take about 116 years at the rate that he's paying it off right now.
Let me ask you a different question, and that's if we look at the word substantial from any source, and that would suggest that you would link substantial to source. Has there been a determination that each of these deposits was a substantial source?
I think there is. If we reference the ledger for that year, he had 9 deposits of $300, 9 deposits of $100, a deposit of $200, one of $150, and one of $50. Those are all from outside sources, from family and friends. And whether those,
but each of those,
but is each of those substantial, 300 or 150?
Well, again, it all goes to context. He earned through prison wages in that same time period $388. So a single deposit of $300, it's fairly substantial. That's a year's worth of earnings for him, almost a year's worth of earnings. He got $4,000. He only got 9 deposits of that amount. I would posit that is substantial. And it's substantial not only just from his perspective, it's substantial from the victim's perspective, who is not receiving much money at all from this defendant.
Well, do you agree that you need to look at each deposit individually rather than cumulatively?
I don't believe we have to look at it. I think opposing counsel keeps using the word single source. He reads the word single into a statute where the word single doesn't exist. I think that there can be an accumulation of money because the examples in the statute talk about settlements and judgments and a lot of those things like the government put in their briefing.
Those are singular. You know, if you get a settlement, usually, you get a lump sum and there may be some payout. You get an inheritance. But if different family members or friends, former colleagues, sent money individually, 150 here, 100 there, 150 here. Don't you think you have to look at each of those individually to determine if there was, as they say, substantial from any source?
I don't think you have to look at them in the individual, just a single one, because we're not talking about just taking the single $300 payment. We're talking about, the panel mentioned earlier that any sources is plural, could be any sources, and that we're looking at whether they have substantial resources combined.
That's a different question. I mean, I think that we don't really know the answer here to how do you make the judgment that something is substantial, and what do you benchmark it against? And it looks to be from, when they say any source, it means, I think what they're talking about is that it could come from anywhere. It could come from God, it could come from friend, family, whatever. And then they have these three examples, which we'll get to. But don't you have to look at each of those individually to determine if it's substantial?
Again, I think that you look at whether the defendant has substantial resources in their inmate account from any source. And at the time we're looking at it, he had received over the course of the year $4,000 and spent it down to $1,600. I think you could look at it that way. I think you could also look at it from the individual sources. And like they said, a $300 payment might not appear substantial necessarily, but you have to look at it in the context of the prisoner from what their earnings and also what the victim is receiving.
And this goes back to your apparent concession that prison wages don't fall under the statute, just categorically. And that's because prison wages can never be substantial.
Yeah, I don't believe that they would be substantial in this situation.
So if those numbers are equivalent to what somebody's sending, a friend sends, then that also should have the same equivalency, no?
Yeah, but he has much more than just one friend payment in there. He has four thousands of dollars of friend payments in there, not just one payment. I would agree with Your Honor.
How much prison wages is he making a month?
In that year, he made $388 a year. So that calculates to about $35 a month.
But if you're saying that the accumulation, say he got no other money from anyone else, he just got prison wages, he's in till another 15 years, it sounds like, he could have $4,500. That would all be prison wages. And you would say, no, we can't touch that.
I think that in that scenario, given the way that the case law has gone, and I would agree that this is where there is no circuit split, because Kidd also talks about prison wages being excluded, and Carson talks about prison wages being excluded, and the First Circuit in Samish talks about prison wages being excluded. We have other avenues like 3664K or 3664M that we could, I think, at that point, use. Here we're talking about substantial resources from any source in his account in 3664N under plain language.
So you would say that even under the scenario I gave, where he, say, he doesn't touch his prison wages for the next 15 years, he has $4,500, you would not be able to touch that under this provision. You'd have to go at it under K or...
Yeah, and I think that goes to, I'm over time, but I think that goes to the overall context of the MVRA as well, that the Congress has given the government numerous tools to go after any property.
Here's the problem, because if you're right on that, and your position is $4,500, you couldn't do it under this provision, then I don't understand how you can go after $1,300 or with the $1,600 here under the same theory.
Well, I think that's being too focused on the amount, the equivalence of the amounts, and rather than the sources of them.
Substantial forces us to do? I mean, how else do we look at substantial? I mean, you're right, there's a whole bunch of variables, but substantial at the end of the day has to be pegged to the amount.
It does, but there's also the any source aspect of it as well, and I think the limitation
read literally
would include prison wages. Yes.
That's the problem. Is the case law is going over here for understandable reasons that collide with the statute. So another question I have is, in your view, how does subsection K intersect with subsection N?
I believe it's just that they can be overlapping provisions, and I think that the government could have gone to the court under both theories. We felt that 3664N works just fine in this
and
this
scenario. Requires a material change, right?
And K, which requires a material change, and there's slightly different notice provisions, which are easy enough to deal with. But when you look at partly what's getting into the context, when you look at the combination of 3664M, which talks about any and available means, and 3664N, which talks about this, and 3664K, which talks about if there's a material change, we can go in there and have the court order it. You're looking at a comprehensive scheme where the Congress is repeatedly saying, if a defendant has resources, there are various ways for the government to get it, and we're going to put very few limitations. And what the opposing side is trying to do here is to read in limitations that Congress clearly did not put in the statute. They're trying to add a word windfall into there that's not in the statute, like Your Honor's talked about. They're trying to add the word single in there, which is not in the statute. And, you know, in preparation for today, I was reading Judge McEwen's Hankins decision, where you talk about giving the MVRA the force of it and not rewriting statutes to limit the MVRA, but actually to fill in the gaps to give it the force and effect that it's required. And I think that's what is warranted here in this case.
Is there, in talking about what is substantial, do we need to take inflation into account? Isn't the MVRA, when was it, a 1980s law?
1996.
So three times as much, and any given dollar is only worth one third of what it was when the law was passed. $300 have been substantial back in 1980?
Well, I'm not the best position to answer that, but yes, I believe that you could look, but again, I think it's kind of the comparison to the context and what the person is paying, what the victim is receiving. The courts talk about that. And so I'm going to go back to the example. For this defendant, if he's paying $25 a quarter or even $25 a month, that's $100 to $300 a year. A $1,200 recovery for the victim, that's 4 years, at least 4 years worth of recovery in one hit. I would say that's very substantial. Maybe $300
isn't.
Victim
in this case?
I'm sorry?
Who is the victim in this case?
The victim's car dealerships.
These are people who dealt with them in the car. Okay.
Yeah. And I'm way over time. If the court has any other questions.
Thank you. You've been very helpful.
Yeah, thank you.
We'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. I don't know if you can cut multiple Gordian knots, but it cuts a ton of them to just deal with this under subsection K and reserve subsection N for windfalls. You deal with the penological problems that Judge Boggs has identified, where there's all sorts of perverse incentives involving families deciding, let's not provide economic support to our incarcerated family members. You cut...
That always exists for anyone who has a judgment against them. I mean, whether they're in prison or not. I mean, why should we exempt a prisoner, you know, and say, oh, you're entitled to receive funds of support, but if you were outside of the prison and somebody gave you a lot of money, you could go collect on that.
You're not exempting the prisoner. You're letting a judge step in under subsection K and make an interest of justice determination that weighs all of these factors, weighs the victim's interest and the victim's rights, but also weighs the penological concerns about, you know, it's true. Mr. Myers has, until 2040 in prison. And so what's he doing? Saving up money that he's receiving in his pre-release custody account? He's making sure that the folks who are giving him money right now, they may not be there when he gets out because it's a long time from now. And so he's making sure I've got enough money so that I can get on my feet when I finally get out of custody. That should be encouraged. At the very least, a court should be allowed to look at it from an interest of justice perspective and should be allowed to decide, you know, do we want to encourage that, or is this...
I think all that is true because it does say may, right? It isn't...
Shall.
And
is shall.
N is shall,
correct.
K is may?
Correct. N is shall. N is mandatory. So holding that you can seize this as a shall, mandatory, we got to take it, it creates the problems that Judge Boggs identified. You know, it also creates, the government was really struggling to draw a line, okay, maybe $200 is substantial resources. That goes against a ton of district courts that have said it's not the case. Maybe $500. Again, you're asking judges to do this, you know, how many grains of sand is a heap problem with no equitable backstop, no interest of justice analysis that can actually inform that assessment. If you reserve it for windfalls, much easier for a judge to make a non-arbitrary determination.
Isn't there some reasonable determination between windfalls and zero? You know, I mean, it doesn't have to be a windfall to go down your route, right? Aren't you kind of cabining how the court could exercise the mandatory requirement?
I think, so windfall may be a triggering word. I use it because the courts use it, and I recognize it's not ideal. You could just say a large single source out of the ordinary grant or something like that, something that really focuses the analysis and says it's much easier to make, as a practical matter as a judge, much easier to make that call than to do this fine line drawing of like, okay, when did this aggregation of stuff become substantial versus, you know, not quite substantial? That line drawing needs to happen. Regardless, like judges are in the business of line drawing, but when you want to do that kind of line drawing, you want to have equitable backstops. You want judges to be able to grasp onto something like the interest of justice.
Well, I'm not sure we do. I think we want statutory backstops, and unfortunately, Congress. I mean, this is not unusual. We're trying to interpret what Congress did, but I don't think they put equitable backstops in there.
Well, Congress,
I think some courts have read that into it, but that seems to have created more of a problem than helping.
My view is that Congress, in its inestimable wisdom, put the equitable backstop in subsection K. That's where courts must consider the interests of justice. I use, again, that's, you know, an interest of justice analysis, which is how courts can draw lines in a sensible, rational way. Congress giving, you know, recognizing that there's a how many sand, grains of sand make a heap problem and saying, okay, let's let judges make that decision in a way that actually, like, sensibly can draw a line, which you have to draw the line through applications of interest of justice principles once to avoid arbitrariness.
What you're saying is that you've got to get some credence to K. It's got to play some role. Otherwise, it's surplusage if you can always go in under these multiple sources under N, correct?
Totally.
Is that the bottom line?
That is the bottom line. And I rest on that articulation of my case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments in the case. The case is now submitted.